Okay, we're recording. Good to see everybody. I want to make mention of something before we launch back into the Gemara, where we will pick up with the verse Vayehi Bitzoh Aharon Vayomer Moshe, where we'll go along one of the lines of thought that came from the last class about the verse that so travels the Ark of the Covenant, and that it has 85 letters in that verse, and thus the scroll that has 85 letters, whether they're together or found in some different disparate places, can actually be saved from the fire on Shabbat, came up as an issue, so we're going to pick back up over there. I just want to make mention of one thing that we didn't necessarily stop on the last time, and that is just to refill our minds of what kinds of things the rabbis taught about in a Braita on 115b1. Tanu Rabbanan, the rabbis taught in a Braita, v'habrachot v'hakmein, blessings and amulets, af al pi sheyesh behen otiyot shel shem u'ma'anyinot harbei v'shabbatorai, although they contain letters of God's name and verses from many sections of the Torah. So, I just want to point out that we said amulets there. We talked about blessings and how the rabbis were actually progenitors of the whole system of blessings, and that one of Chazal's projects, Chachamim Zichronan Levracha, is where Chazal comes from, right? The notion that our sages of blessed memory is that small acronym, Chazal. So Chazal had a project. They wanted to teach people blessings, and thus they sent forward blessings, and they would have small written texts with blessings on them, and they would pen them with God's name. They also had these amulets. We talked a little bit about over the past what we call superstition, but the trust that was out there in the names of God as being central and a kind of foundational idea in our ancestors' lives, all the way up to and including the time just before modernity. And that amulets, in a certain sense, are the protective writings that were some of the newest ways to bring together verses and lines of poetry even, or just names of God, in a way that kept them, A, aesthetically in our midst, so you didn't need an ark and a holy ark to have such a small text exist. B, you could actually create jewelry with them, and people could wear them, and a lot of times you saw that amulets were created into jewelry over the years and years, and before they were jewelry proper, or perhaps as part of what was jewelry in the ancient world, you know, if you want to call some of the original amulets, the metal upon which verses of Torah were inscribed or etched, and that they were worn, we have evidence from archaeological finds that in fact these kinds of things existed. I mentioned as a source that's always an interesting kind of place to turn. I'm not sure there's one on the shelves here. Interesting if there was not. Yeah, there is. So, over here is the Encyclopedia Judaica. And let me lift up one of the volumes. This is a standard volume of the printing that was done in 1972. The entire Jewish Encyclopedia is online. The entire text of the 1906 version of the Jewish Encyclopedia is online and is a great resource, sometimes that has longer articles than any article you might find in this reference, the Encyclopedia Judaica, I'm sorry. And in this volume particularly is an article about amulets, and I'll pass this around. So you'll see that in one instance, there are little amulets with all kinds of Hebrew lettering that have indeed God's name all over them, and then amulets throughout the centuries that did the same, put forth God's name as protective signs and inspirations for when people were davening or in prayer. Some people use them simply to ward off the evil eye. Some people use them as what's called a shviti, because there's a verse that says, shviti Hashem lenegdi tamid. I always put God, I sat God in front of me, or I in essence, saw God in front of me always. And that is written up on lots of synagogue walls, and or within a beautiful type of artwork that is presented in the synagogue as a focal point for those who might need it. And some are smaller, and some are larger. So...
Don't we have shiviti over the ark?
What's that?
Downstairs? Don't we have a shiviti Adonai l'negdi tamid?
Yeah.
Downstairs, we have it.
Yeah, we do.
Over the ark.
We do. So, by us, it's engraved into the stone. And we don't necessarily have it as an amulet.
I'll tell you a story. Question about jewelry. Can you tell us more about it? Women wearing jewelry?
Well, we don't have, I'll tell you with these, we don't have the entire history of any piece that we find archaeologically, but we do have some of a review in the Middle Ages, in up through shtetl life, that people would, A, they would put such a shviti, God's name, and an amulet of protection on the new bassinet, on the baby's bassinet.
The evil eye was really a big thing.
I mean, not just a big thing. People fundamentally believe that you have to keep this kind of evil out of your midst. And for sure, we have named it Jewish magic and superstition, and this one is the study of such within the study in folk religion in Jewish terms from Middle Ages forward. And this is by Joshua Trachtenberg, who... I believe was at Yale for a long time, and who did this work, comparative work between Jewish culture and non-Jewish culture, and then a lot with the war against the spirits. And as a matter of fact, you know, people can look at what the Baal Shem Tov, the name of the Baal Shem Tov, Yisrael ben Eliezer, is not what he's known for. He's known as a Baal Shem Tov. He was not the only Baal Shem Tov. The Baalei Shem Tov was a group of people within Eastern Europe, 18th century, who were good at commanding the names of God, both in ritual terms and in terms of amulet practice and writing texts that would be worn or kept in other books. And those amulets would protect against these evil spirits and send out not only the evil eye, but shadim. They would send out demons. And that we could have a very serious conversation about how this function within our community, the rabbis were privy to that. There will be an instance in the Gemara in just a little bit that if we get to it today, that you're going to see that there's a little bit of potentially a concern about such a spirit, why one of the rabbis stays away from something. In one of the Gemaras that's most ancient, the Gemara about making the Pesach Seder, pages are dedicated to how people wouldn't walk in a certain either cup, you know, dyads or triads, depending on what they believed about the spirits that inhabited any given area or what they were really up against. The name of God came to be something that Baalei Shem Tov, a Baal Shem Tov was kind of like a doctor who would come into your space and rid the space of either the evil eye, the Ein Hara, or such a spirit. So the fact that in our Gemara you have such writings that may or may not have exactly worked in any which one of the ways I'm expressing we use them for at this point. The fact that it's there, though, it says that they were using the names of God in such a way that had a little bit more of that order of business attached to it. That God was not just the commander and not just the lawgiver on Sinai, but God was the banisher of evil spirits, of the evil eye, of any shadim, of any demons. And that we know, again, from other places in the Gemara.
So you mentioned this in the context of it being something that was part of the shtetl practice, but I have a very cute story. I'll make it very quick about something that happened to me contemporaneously, in our time. I had a client who received a hazmanah, as we call it. It's really a subpoena to go see a criminal prosecutor.
Uh-huh.
And the prosecutor was investigating contributions that were being made to Rabbanim and so on,
yeah,
that were in the nature of kickback. You know, they were they were money laundering type things, you'd make a contribution of $100 and get $90 back, and you know, you'd have a $100 deduction. And
uh-huh.
The rabbi got 10 and you got a deduction. So my client, if you can believe this, had made a contribution to a rabbi who knocked on his door of $675,000 at a time when that was a huge amount of money. Why? Because they were he was helping in the architectural plans for the construction of the new Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem when it was about to happen. And so I spoke with him and I had to prepare him for his appearance. He was an old friend of somebody I had already represented. And I said, listen, you know, you can't go and see
a guy you have to represent every time.
You can't go and see a prosecutor and act as if you're cooperating and tell him a book of ISA like you're making a contribution to the Beis HaMikdash here. I mean, this is not going to fly. He said, well, I did. I mean, a guy came into your, he knocked on your door and he told you about this and you gave him that. He says, yes. I said, are you sure? Okay, so we had to schedule this meeting, and every date that was possible, he kept saying, I can't do it. And I said, so what's the problem? He said, well, the Rebbe told me that's such and such a date, and you don't do it like 10 days before, 4 days before Tisha B'Av, you can't do it. Or 11 days after such and such, you can't do it. So finally we get a date, and I'm in the car going up. We have to go up to White Plains. And he's sitting next to me, and he made me very uncomfortable because he's doing all kinds of weird things in his So finally I said, what are you doing? And he said, nothing. And I said, what are you having? What are you doing? And he pulled out amulets.
Right.
All these little crazy looking things. And I said, what is this? He said, well, you know, I need it. The Rebbe told me I should have it. And this is before the Rebbe had died. And he told me I need to do this and, you know, keep God here with me and he'll protect me and nothing will happen. So, of course, his story was actually true. We went and we had a very good session, and the prosecutor was really only interested in drying up these contributions because he thought these people were very bad guys and put the fear of God literally into him. But it was what, I mean, it's really this.
Right, so it really is alive. It really is alive. And not to say I know exactly where it exists, though you had this one experience, but there are neighborhoods in which you could definitely find someone to write you a good, good amulet.
How far removed is this from idol worship?
It's far removed. They didn't see it as any bit having to do with idol worship whatsoever. The name of God written on a piece of paper is a holy process.
Against, you're going against spirits.
They absolutely believed in a spirit's life. They absolutely believed in shedim and demons. They absolutely believed in the world of the ayin hara, the evil out there beyond your own evil inclination internally. They got it from the nature of human existence, that there were forces that opposed. This was, instead of being Zoroastrian and having a god of evil against the god of good, these were the forces that we understood already from the Bible to be at work against the god of our creation. We didn't need any place to look other than Torah, and this is John Levinson, who was visited here, I believe, work in creation and the persistence of evil, where he'll show you in many, many places, both in the story of creation and in the Psalms, that part of the taming of the evil spirits that God did was to send the crocodile back into its place, and the great epic battles of the good force of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh Adonai against the evildoers of the world, including Satan, that we gave the world the idea about, there's an advocate and there's, right, senegor. The senegor is the...
Defense.
Right, so there's the categor who's...
Prosecutor.
It's like the prosecutor, except that it's beyond prosecutor.
The accuser.
Right, that's the English word that's used. So the Hebrew is categor and senegor, and it's the accuser and the defender. And so there are those who are the accusers and the evildoers and the spirits, and then there are the ones who defend, and God is the ultimate defender of the Jewish people. So God is the ultimate defender of the Jewish people is represented by what? Nothing other than the holy letters that are the lavush, it's not really an idol. It's simply the way that human beings need to call upon God's presence in the world. So therefore, we're fighting the spirits and the divine realm of evil that exists, as opposed to the divine God with whom God is in battle.
So if the Kamea is such a good idea, how come there was a fire, number one? And why we need to let it get burned?
Okay, so we live in Olam Hazeh. The rabbis are fully aware that this world has fires in it. The rabbis are fully aware that God's name cannot absolutely protect you from everything. They'll let it burn at the cost of letting your life go down with the flames and to let you basically continue to keep Shabbat, which is more important than, in this case, the saving of a text with God's name on it. So they're Sephardic people. They have certain sense. They also have the project of introducing Shabbat, and they know that they can't have you save everything. It really is a matter of the what seems... You could take something to the nth extreme. Like, your question is good in this sense, that a lot of times the exercise in the Gemara itself is going to the full, let's say, theological or spiritual extremes of a position that somebody takes. So, in other words, if I go to the position that God is never in any evil, and that evil only exists outside of God, if I'm a student of theology, and I take that to its absolute ends, and I only hold that, then I have a serious problem with the moment that someone who has been good in their lives and godly ultimately turns to do something evil. So if I don't believe, like our rabbi said, that God has given us both the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov, the inclination for good and the inclination for evil, and I don't attribute it to godly creation to have some aspect of both, I have a problem theologically. Same goes with a spiritual argument. If I say that God's name is so holy that it can protect against fire, and I want it to be the ultimate protective shield, how could I possibly allow for it to be burned in the fire? You could do that because, at a certain level, the rabbis particularly are concerned with the practical reality of life and the buildup of the Shabbat culture. And so they want certain texts to also be canonical and central, and therefore they're willing to go that way. So I answer the question with all of that seriousness to say, it's true, that could be like a Hava Amina in the Gemara. You could say, if it's God's name and it protects so much, why couldn't you say, go save it? They're unwilling. They're willing to work on the other two projects, safety and life, project of Shabbat.
Oh, I see. The story about מעשה באחד שהיה כותב בצעידן, באו והביאו רבי ישמעאל, הלך רבי ישמעאל לבודקו, כשהיה עולה בסדר, הגיש בו, צפה. It looks like this guy didn't want רבי ישמעאל to know what he was doing, which is what it was from.
Which story are you bringing to air?
The last time.
Can you just summarize it in English?
Oh, gee, you summarize it. The one who was writing Kotzei Bracho, there was someone who used to write Kotev Vitzaydan, whatever that Saydan is, someone who's writing probably blessings and amulets. And then Rabbi Ishmael comes to check him up.
Oh, yeah.
And he noticed that he's coming up, so he dumps
coming
it
up
in...
Coming up the ladder.
Right.
So he dumps it in water to hide it. My point is that apparently it was... He came Levodko, he came to check up on him. So it was frowned upon. This whole practice must have been frowned upon.
It definitely
otherwise,
was.
Why would he dump it into water and to conceal his
look, Meir is pointing out the following tension.
It's not exactly mainstream.
Absolutely. Meir is pointing out to a tension in the Gemara between the written texts that have God's name. If you're going to write small texts that have brachot, if you're going to write texts that are amulets, there's a story we read last time where, remember, he goes and checks on this guy who's said to be doing this, and he tries to dissolve everything, right, gets rid of the evidence in the water. It is somewhat side religion. It's the
not exactly mainstream.
That goes so far as to say that the rabbis are highly aware of religious practices that they're very suspect of, that they frown upon, that they don't want to define as being normative, that they don't define as creating text that is text that's worth saving should a fire break out on Shabbat. What we're doing here is kind of getting a picture of the rabbis making some priorities vis-a-vis the texts that are being circulated for religious purposes. In that sense, we have also the observation made by scholars that the notion of having amulets for protection by God, with God's name, and having this kind of spirit life, it may not be idol worship per se, but it for sure points to a direction within our tradition of people having a different kind of relationship with what we call tseruf otiot, the combining of letters to make God's name. Instead of just Yud being the letter Yud, it's, you know, Yud is Yud, Vav, Dalet, Yud. Vav is Vav, Aleph, Vav, or Vav, Vav. He is He, He, or He, Aleph, He. You know, all these kinds of traditions that we don't know exactly their origin and their moment of departure, but that we have in hints in our Gemara certain type of approaches to religion that looks a little bit different than mainstream rabbinism, mainstream Chazal. In that sense, Chazal's project is to find a scroll with 85 letters that you're allowed to save. I just want to remind us as we get back into the text now, because I'd like to wrap up this part of the conversation and get into the Gemara, that remember that Rav Huna Bar Chalav inquired of Rav Nachman, Sefer Torah She'ein Bo Lilat Kit Shmonim V'Chamesh Otiot, a Torah scroll in which there is not sufficient writing to gather 85 letters, right? In other words, most of the Torah scrolls are erased, and it's the number of intact letters and words scattered throughout the scroll does not total 85. Kagon Parshat Vayhi Binto Aharon, like the 85 letters that are found in this little section of the Torah, Vayhi Binto Aharon. If you can't find those, what do you do? And in other words, Matzilin Otam Ivnei Delekao Ein Matzilin. There's a question whether I save it or whether I don't save it. This measure of 85 letters becomes the normative letter for saving or not saving within a Torah scroll. So why single out this section? If you look inside a Torah scroll, there's the two inverted nuns at the beginning of this section written in the Torah and at the end of this section written in the Torah. There are two literally inverted nuns. So this little section is thought of as a book unto itself. Just to keep that in mind now, as we get back into the Gemara on 115b3. 115b3.
What is it in the regular
text? It's 115.
Kuf Tet
Vav. Sad Bet.
Towards the bottom.
Yeah, I'm going to be in Tanu Rabbanan, the very bottom of the bottom two lines. Second to last wide line. End of the line. Tanu Rabbanan. Vayehi bin Soa Ha'aron. When it comes to this verse, Vayehi bin Soa Ha'aron, Vayomer Moshe, the verse that we use for the opening of our Torah service, the verse that is 85 letters, which created our measurement, Parsha zo asalo HaKadosh Baruch Hu simaniot milamala lamata. This little portion of Torah, God made for it signs or symbols of the overturned nuns, both before it and after it. Lomar, that is to say, or to teach you, she'ein ze mekoma. That's not its place. We're now on 116A1 for those in the art school. Kuf Tet Zion.
Kuf Tet Zion.
Kuf Tet Zion. So it's to teach you what? Ein Mekayma. It's not in its place. Rashi says, first wide line of the Rashi on the inside, She'ena Re'u Yalachan. This part of the Torah is not actually supposed to be fitting in here. Physically. In the narrative. Delav Bahalichot Masaot Mishtaye La'el Mina. It's not dealing with the section of the Torah that we're in now, with all the laws here. that section really goes with the section called Digalim, the flags, meaning the description of the camp that the Israelites set up. So it doesn't go in this section. Befarshat Bamidbar Sinai, at the very beginning of Bamidbar it belongs, not in the middle. So if that's the case, that a section of the Torah can be in the wrong place, then the Kodesh Baruch Hu provided us the signs that would tell us as such. The signs happen to be the inverted nuns. And if you go to any of the Torah scrolls that we have in circulation in our Beit Knesset or in anywhere around the world, you'll see standard practice, the inverted nuns around that section of the Torah. Now, what's radical about the question, of course, if the Torah was given at Sinai and it was all given by Kodesh Baruch Hu to Moshe and Moshe taught us, how could it be that you have any kind of question about the positioning of a certain verse or two in the Torah scroll itself? That it exists as a possibility in the Talmud is the open door to understanding that there's oral Torah and that not everything in the world is fixed exactly as we understand it. That there is a future time, that things may be different for the Jewish people. Rabbi Omer, when you have, if you have the traditional Gemara, you just have a resh. And if you're looking here, it says Rebbe, right? Because the way we say Rabbi is really Rebbe in the English. Rabbi refers to who? Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi being the editorial manager of the entire project of the Mishnaic sages at Yavne, who was the editor-in-chief of the Mishnah according to our Masoret. He was the editor-in-chief. When he has a position, it often means that people are very respectful. It doesn't mean that he gets the right to overwrite anybody else. But it does mean that we respect kind of that, here's a teaching in Rebbe's name. So that's why he gets Rebbe. And it doesn't have to say Rebbe Yehuda Nazi. If I may continue just through the thoughts of the section. Lo min Hashem huzeh. It's not for this reason, these nuns. It's not to tell you what, that it's in the wrong place. Eila mineshe sefer chashuvu bifnei atzmo. Rather, the nuns don't tell you it's out of place. I can't, that's not my tradition. My tradition is to simply tell you that what? It's a sefer chashuv. It's a very important book unto itself. Kaman azla ha de amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, amar Rabbi Yonatan, as I have in the tradition of Rabbi Nachman, in the name of Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, in the name of Rabbi Yonatan. Chatva amude hashiva. He quotes a verse being from Mishle. Elu shiva sifrei Torah. That the verse comes from Mishle and it says, wisdom has built her house, is the part before it. She has hewn out her seven pillars. What then are the seven pillars? Elu Shiva Sifrei Torah. What's surprising? Seven books of Torah. How do we get to seven? Bereshit, Shemot, Vayikra. Bereshit, Shemot, Vayikra, the first three. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. First third of Bamidbar. Small section of 85 letters, Vayihi Bintzo Haron. Second section of Bamidbar, or a third in this case. Then add the third. And then you have Devarim, Deuteronomy. So seven books of Torah, verses 5. That's the tradition of Rabbi Yonatan, who heard it in the tradition of Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, who took it from the fact that the Mishle, the wisdom literature says, wisdom has hewn this home, seven pillars. Seven pillars of the Jewish people. Why is that a nice number for us? 7 days of creation. Seventh day is Shabbat. Simply the suggestion that you could have seven books is an interesting hava mina. But the Gemara wants to challenge this notion, and it's not going to just rest there. Come on. Oh, no, let's just finish up that thought. And who's that? Who's that system like? Karebi. That's like Rebbe. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Who held that? it wasn't a matter of it being in a different place, but that you had seven books and this was in the right place. It's to say that it's a sefer, very important. What that does to the word sefer, also, if it can be only 85 letters, and we think of the word sefer as being book, but now we're talking about a sefer that's all of 85 letters long. Interesting. Mantana de Slagale de Rebbe. So Gemara comes and says, well, who's the one who's arguing with Rebbe? If Rebbe holds that it's really seven books of the Torah, I want to know, who's willing to, you know, be in the fight with Rebbe, Yehuda Anasi? Ah, here's who it was, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel who. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is the one who has the argument with Rebbe. The Tanya, as we have in a Braita, Rash Bagomer, Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel says, Atida, Parsha zo shete aker mikan vetikatev bimkoma. In the future, it will be that this sefer, this portion, Vayehi b'Tzoah Aharon, 85 letters long, will be ripped from its current place in the middle of Bamidbar, and it will be put back into its place over there by where the camp was set up and in the Parsha of Bamidbar. Rashi, what does it mean, Atida, Parashazu? So, Rashi says about Atida, the word Atid is the future, right? Atida, in its future. Le'atid, that is, in the future. She'yihiyu kol ha'puraniyut betelin. That in the future, when all of the griping and complaining of the Jewish people and the punishments meted out because either of their sins or the annals of history have to be fulfilled by God delivering the punishments upon the people, that it, in that time, lo yidagu l'furaniyut, there's not going to be any punishment anymore. There's not going to be any hard time anymore. V'yetzer hara batel, and also the evil inclination of people is nullified entirely. At that point, the parashat Vayehi b'Tzoah Aharon that we got up with this great ark of the covenant that has the law in it, it will go back to its proper place in the camp section in the description of the camp. So the notion that you have the two nuns, then we have to ask, what is it really getting to? What is it really getting to? So not only is it a messianic idea, but it's probably a mystical and messianic idea. The nuns themselves represent the number 50. It says in Kabbalistic literature, which again is mystical literature that has some of its roots in pre-Provence times and has its roots back in even rabbinic literature, which we now know Professor Edel at the Hebrew University is big on telling and showing us where all of the mythos of the Kabbalah, the structural realities of some of the textual leanings of the mystics proper, either started or got their real ideas. So here the 50th gate is the gate that you enter into once you pass through the 49 gates of Tuma, the 49 gates of obfuscation, of ritual impurity, of not being ready for the camp that is truly moving in God's wind, God's ruach, God's power. That could be one idea. Another is that Rashi's taking the notion of the Yetzer Hara in the 11th century and adding that, actually, to what the Gemara brings forward as the idea of the Poraniyut that's Batel, the punishments and the griping, the complaining, the punishments, the griping, and all of the unfolding of history. In other words, Rashi himself internalizes the spiritual message to say that once you get and rid of and overcome your personal Yetzer Hara, then that's when the Jewish people is merits this move of this Parsha, as opposed to the Gemara, which really showed God's anger, because Puran Yud is really the word here to indicate it's about the actions of the Jews and God's response and God's anger and the punishments we'll receive. Nothing about the internal Yetzer Hara. So the interesting piece that I wanted to point out here with the Rashi is that it seems as though reading the text in its plainest sense, the Peshat of the Gemara, really doesn't deal with the Yetzer Hara. That the Yetzer Hara is a Rashi idea. And the Puran Yud, the punishment and overcoming the complaining that the Jewish people did and the punishment that God had to mete out, is the one that the Gemara is focused on. So, it says the following about Puran Yud. V'lama ketava kan. Then why did it put it here in the first place? Why did this portion of Vayihi Bin Sarah Aharon have to appear in the middle of Bamidbar? Why couldn't it have been in the beginning? Kedei v'hafsik bein Puran Yud Rishona l'Puran Yud Shnia. So that it could make a distinction between the first and the second times of God's punishment and the Jewish people's having to repent. Puranut Shnia Mahi, it starts with the second and is going to go to the first. What's the second one you're mentioning? Vayehi ha'am kemit onanim. The first one is that the people, they were what? Complainers. That the single biggest reason that the Jewish people had to have any punishment by God is that they were such complainers. No resonance to today. So, then it says, Puran Yud Rishona, and the first matter of the problem, what is that one? Vayis'u Mehar Sinai. And they traveled on from Mount Sinai. Now, that doesn't seem so bad. They left Mount Sinai after the entire theophany, after the revelation of the law, after the giving of Torah. What was so wrong with traveling from there?
Maybe it's the ego.
So, okay, it's one possibility. The Tosafot clue us into what the oral tradition was about what this really meant, this verse. So the first Tosafot on the page, if you have the, if you look at the traditional blot of the Vilna edition, if you're looking at the art scroll, it's on the left side of where we are now, and it's the first entry with the large Pei Vav Resh Ayin Nun Vav Tav, kind of in the middle of the page, right under where it says Perek Shisha Asar. Puranut. Puranut Rishona. Okay? Puranut Rishona Vayis'u. And Amar Rabbi Chanina Shesaru Me'afarei Hashem. And Rabbi Chanina kind of explained this, and they traveled from Mount Sinai, from the mountain of God, as Shesaru Me'afarei Hashem. They turned their back on God. So immediately they had this theophany, immediately they received the Torah, and the idea is that here's why they had the punishment waiting for them, because they immediately then turned their back on God. And the way that Tosafot explain it, see if this is another one of those experiences that resonates with anyone in the room. Perush Bekontras, so we have a little bit of a written tradition in our Beit Midrash. That's basically, and in the Rashi, Shmeaz Itchilu Lish'ol Basar. The Rashi says, the Rashi commentary here is that's when they started to think about what they were going to complain about. So this is like really unbelievable commentary on the Jewish people. But the second one was that they complained. The first one was that they thought about what they were going to complain about. So that's Rashi. V'omer Rabbi Yitzhak, the Israeli came. I don't really think so, the Tosafot Rabbi Yitzhak says. Ela, rather, Poranut Rishona Kida Amar B'Midrash. I'm going to tell you that the first Poranut, the first time around, was a little bit more like this, that as it's brought down in Midrash. Anybody who sees their Yilam Beinu in the Hebrew, that is from the Tanhuma literature, right? Yilam Deinu. Vayis'u, when it said the word that they traveled from the mountain of God, Shinas'u mihar Sinai derech shloshet yamim, they went 3 days, and they ran away. After the 3 days there, they ran away. Ketinok hayotzei mi beit ha-sefer sheboreach lo v'holech lo. Like a kid who's at school who just absolutely cannot stand it anymore and runs right away. That was the reason why the first one deserved punishment. Now, that is quite a commentary on what happens, not only in Jewish circles, but with humanity in and of itself, you know? That, A, the first one was they were truly hungry for meat. They only had the man, right? The tradition is the man came, and even if it tasted like everything, you know, what's this seitan that's shaped into a chicken patty? The first one is... Who would prefer the seitan?
The seitan created.
So the first one was not necessarily the thinking about what they were going to complain about. The first one was that they got this lesson. They got all of Torah. They just had the most incredible experience of all time. And they ran away. They just turned and said, no way. They ran from that classroom. And I think it's a commentary that they're willing to put on the page to identify just how difficult it is sometimes that we should learn what it means to be a good Jew, what it means to be a person striving to bring God's Kedusha into the world, God's holiness into the world, and that we can't really be there. It's our humanness overcomes us. And until that time, the story of the bringing out of the ark needs to be in and amidst the stories of the struggle of leadership of Moses and Miriam. It needs to be in the struggles of bringing the right kind of attitude to God and in God's house. And it's not just a matter of the aesthetic of where it is among the flags and when the camp would reset itself in the kind of orderly way that troops are engaged and do it. They reset it into the wilderness, and here's where the ark went, and here's where the flags went. It's not in there. It's not in that section of Torah. It's more in the guts of Torah in Bamidbar, where we really were the children of the Midbar, the children of the desert, the children wandering through. That's the core story of being human and struggling to understand what the being at Sinai was really all about. That dialogue is happening through the Gemara and Rashi and the Tosafot, making it so on this page of Gemara, which I find extravagant and I find absolutely spiritually and midrashically quite wondrous here, where the Tosafot bring a different source that Rashi truly had on his own bookshelf and could have himself gone. This is the dialogue between Rashi and Tosafot sometimes on a page of Gemara, how they go a different direction, one with a midrash from the Tanhuma, one with a nod to Bamidbar Rabba, bringing two different midrash to make meaning of Torah verses themselves. So this is where the Gemara ultimately, you know, winds up. V'heichan mekoma, where exactly is its place? Amar Rav Ashi b'degalim. So he says, its true place, Rav Ashi says, is truly with the first chapter of Bamidbar. And that it will ultimately arrive there, seems the Gemara to say, at some time in the future, when we stop running away from the mountain of God, and we stop thinking about what to complain about. Or complaining. Yeah. So that's the interesting sugya. It's going to now get back into some more technical questions. about our issue that the Mishnah brought forward. What do we save on Shabbat and what do we not save? If there's a fire that should break out. So the Gemara makes a transition. Any comment or question on this part that we need to address before we move on to this next section?
The Yudanasi was in Jerusalem or he was in Yavne? Because
Yudanasi
was Rabbi Yochanan ben Shammai.
Zakai.
Ben Zakai. So.
Yeah. So
here it looks like he was in Yavne, but he didn't go down to Yavne.
Well, Rebbe was in Yavne.
But in Jerusalem? He was the head of the Sanhedrin. That was in Jerusalem.
Yeah, but at that time of the Mishnah, right? He was the project editor of the Mishnah.
So he moved down, he was saved, and he moved down...
He moved with the Sanhedrin. You know, there's a whole line of places that Rabbi Yehuda Nasi ultimately went with the Sanhedrin as well, but to chart his life...
Because I think the guy who negotiated with the Roman was Yochanan ben Zakkai. He made the deal.
That was the year 70.
Right.
So the year 200 is the year of the Mishnah. So we're talking about later in the generations of Tanaim, when the sages had already moved to Yavne. And we say that the Mishnah was really the... Yeah, so ultimately, I say Yavne and the sages of Yavne because ultimately it's where Yochanan ben Zakkai took the sages out of Jerusalem and the whole project of Tanaim and bringing Torah Sheba Al Peh came alive. But it's true that when you go to Israel and you want to visit Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's place, you go to Tzipori.
And by my house.
Oh, okay.
The burial site is right walking distance from my house.
Yeah, thanks for the geography retool.
In Tzipori,
edited means they wrote a written text of it, or they simply decided what not to pass on.
So the process of creating the Mishnah as it is extant to, you know, Ad Hayom Hazeh, let's say, to this day, is a decision by a council of those Tanaim that probably preceded Rebbe, started in Yavne. As the Sanhedrin and the Council of Chachamim, you know, and had their goings out to the community, coming back to where they would ultimately codify the Mishnah, maybe the better term for us to consistently use is codify. What went in, which minority opinions were kept, what was left on the cutting room floor, what became Tosefta versus Mishnah. There's major, major questions about exactly what that process really was.
Okay. Today we have a written, I can take it off the shelf.
Right.
Could I have come in, if I can, to Yavne when they finished their editing and said, may I see a copy or not?
Yeah, well, you know, our ancient manuscripts, do we have a Tzipori manuscript where Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was supposedly, do we have a Yavne manuscript where some who returned to Yavne went to? We don't really have manuscripts from that time. We have a few...
Let me tell you why I'm asking, because the argument is you shouldn't write it down.
Yeah, because... But remember that the sages started to permitting the written nature of oral Torah because we were afraid it would be lost. That's part of what they decided during this time period, the Tanaim. And it's true that we had people who could remember oral Torah, like they remembered all of written Torah because of the orality of the culture. But it started to be written down and it was passed along in manuscript tradition. And we have certain manuscripts and there's a whole collection of them. We have Vatican, what we call the Vatican manuscript, because it was preserved over there. And then we have three manuscripts that are in the manuscript library at the Hebrew University. We have a couple in the JTS Rare Book Room. These manuscripts of the Mishnah are incredible. You can compare them. There's a database to compare them online. There are some differences between Mishnayot in those manuscripts. What we call a high form of of formal learning in the Mishnah is manuscript comparison to see if words fundamentally change in one place or another. There are some places where it's true that they are different. But the oldest ones we have don't date back to the very moment where the sages themselves were in these cities where the Sanhedrin traveled.
So codified around 200, and then they stopped transcribing again.
Well, they didn't stop transcribing. They kept writing, where ultimately it wound up was that they obviously had some written tradition of the Mishnah when the Gemara started to be written into real form in Gaonic time period. So manuscripts of the Gemara are circulating during the Gaonic period, and into Rashi's hands he has one, and he says, Hachi Gar Sinan. So I have these manuscripts. So there's lots of information about which manuscripts are oldest and which they think now are older than the ones they thought were older before.
So 500, when they were codifying the Gemara, the Talmud.
Starting to.
They were not working entirely by
memory, no.
They had libraries.
Yeah.
What is the approximate date of the oldest manuscript that we know?
You know, I don't want to venture to say, because every day there's new scholarship. I don't know what was in the latest trove of recovered items that we saw from Iraq. I don't know what was in Afghanistan, if there's a section of the Mishnah in the oldest Siddur we have, 11th century now. Some say 7th century. So if there was Mishnayot in there, it'd be interesting to see if there were Mishnayot that were comparable to others. Yeah. So very, very fantastic area of study. And the person that we can turn to who's always aware of these things, you know, we could turn to any of the professors at the seminary. We could turn to Shama Friedman and David Glinken at the Schechter Institute, Professor Friedman there, created an online searchable database of every extant manuscript that we have for any given section of the Talmud or Mishnah. This is part of our contribution to the world of Talmud learners and Mishnah learners like us, who would look at those for comparison in order to sometimes glean understandings of different tracts or sugiyot or mishnayot themselves. So let's push forward in the text. Okay, so we're on page 116a1 in the translation of the Art Scroll, and E by Elohu. Okay, so they asked the question, E by Elohu. 116a1. Kuftet Zayin. E by Elohu. It was asked, Hagil Yonin shel Sefer Torah, Masilino tam mitnei deleika, o ein Masilino tam mitnei deleika. The blank pages of a Sefer Torah, save them from a fire or don't save them from a fire? What does that sound like, the blank pages of a Torah? What would you say off the cuff, right? So that's the question that Rashi is going to ask. He's going to say, do you know what's really meant by saying the blank pages? He wants to clarify for us. Klafim chalakim, that is very smooth skins that have no writing. And ultimately, he says, Chalak shalamala shalamata, and v'nimcha kitavo v'na'asa chalak. They were erased, and now they're blank. Now, why would they keep these around, these erased sheets?
When we use them, we just do the 85 characters for the
Lord. Well, they would keep them around because that parchment was, in essence, very sacred for what I needed to write. Let's say that I did have a scribal tradition that I wanted to now have as part of my collection, and I already had another Sefer Torah. So I might erase an older one, and I might have a scribe write me the new book of this or that part of the canon. Or I might write some teachings of the rabbis. So I might need it to rewrite another Torah as well, because my other one was going to be out of circulation, because the ink we use in our locality wasn't as permanent as the ink that we ultimately came to know as the ink with which we write Torah. It was in flux, as we saw from the sugya about various inks. that were used in the process. So that is what we mean by the Gilayon.
So the scroll was not only that format. I thought was only for a Torah. They would use the scroll for other.
The only format we had. Practically, we didn't have a codex. We didn't have codex yet, and we didn't use tablets in our culture. We used scrolls, pieces of parchment. Okay, so it says, can you save those gilyonim, those blank or not? Tashma, come and learn. Come and hear. Sefer Torah Shebala, im yesh bo lilaket shmonim v'chamesh otiyot, if you have 85 letters, right? Our standard of measurement from the verses, by Hibin Soharon, when the ark would move. If you have 85 letters, Kagon Parshat by Hibin Soharon, Matilin, you save them. Ve'im, love, and if you don't have 85 letters, Ein Matilin, you don't save them. Va'amai. And in essence, they're going to ask now, but why? Derived that it may be saved on account of its blank portion. Now, why don't you say it should be saved on its blank portion, meaning what? You might think that it's talking about the blank page itself that could stand to have written ink in the spot where old ink was written. What they're arguing about here is the observation that not only the space in which the letters of the Torah were written seems to be holy, at least for now. This is the Hava Amina. Let me surmise the following. What about the blank spaces around the writing that I would consider holy? A Sefer Torah isn't simply the small section where there's writing. I consider all of the Yiria, all of the Gilayon, all of the page to be holy, now that I've used it for this holy purpose. So let the fact that I have blank space around that held a Sefer Torah's letters pass along the holiness that was once associated with this scroll. Even though, what? The letters have been erased. The Gemara responds to that possibility. Tashima, come and learn this. Sefer Torah shenimchak, a Sefer Torah that was erased. Im yesh bo lilaket shmonim v'chamesh otiyot, if there is within it 85 letters, kagon parshat vayehi bin Soharon, similar to the section and the ark would then journey. Matzilin, we save it. Ve'im lov ein matzilin, but if not, we may not save it. Va'amai, but why? Tepok le'mishum gilayon didei, derived that it may be saved on account of its blank portion. So the Gemara says, Mekom akatav loka magbayili, in regard to the place on which there was once writing, I have no doubt that it loses its sanctity because I've erased the letters from the place where the writing once stood. Dechi kadosh, because when this portion originally received its sanctity, in other words, when the actual place of the writing of the letters was written upon, that it received a certain amount, a level of kedusha, a level of holiness. Agav ketav hu dekadosh, because it was by the fact that there was writing on it that it became this holy implement. It received the sanctity only on account of the writing on it. Azal ketav azlala kedushate. But when the writing departs, the sanctity of this portion departs as well. Ki kami baili, when am I really in doubt? Shelmal v'shelmata sheben parsha l'parsha ben daf l'daf shebetachilat ha-sefer shebesof ha-sefer. I have any doubts about this when I'm talking not about that portion, which I know is kadosh with the writing and I know is not kadosh anymore without the writing. It's regard to the above and below the writing, between one section and the next, between one column and the next, and at the beginning and the end of the scroll. These portions are intended to what? Remain blank. Therefore, it may be argued that the fact that the whole Torah is now blank is no reason for them to lose their sanctity. In other words, there was never any writing to begin with, and it had a certain level of sanctity. So since you told me the part that I did write with only gets its sanctity when the writing is there, are you going to tell me now that the writing is gone, these portions lose that status of having held the Torah as it held the Torah with the writing? By the fact that you erased the writing doesn't mean that these portions now change. They were blank with the writing. They're blank without the writing. So let it keep its status as a holy vessel, as a holy item.
With today's technology, X-ray could find the writing there even if it was erased.
Very good. And we can, that's the way we see the three letters or three texts all at once on one gilayon, on one piece of parchment.
How is it possible to determine while it's burning whether it has the 85 letters? I mean, as a practical matter, how could that be done?
All right, so I'll answer in very short form.
How does the Gemara answer?
Yeah, the Gemara, I'll answer in short form, what culture was. The Gemara doesn't really necessarily give us a whole sorting routine. What practically was done in ancient times, I mentioned to you in the context of legal documentation from libraries of kings who kept records. I have to imagine that there was somewhat of a system with the Jewish people. A, it could have been that there was some type of wax seal at the base of a rolled scroll into which certain signs were made as to what exists within the scroll itself. That's how records were ultimately kept, so that you didn't have to go back through entire rolled up scrolls that you didn't need for everyday reading. That was one way. That already we found archaeological evidence for. We found the seals themselves for all kinds of records in the ancient world and all kinds of texts, without the texts themselves, because the basically what happened was that the deterioration of the actual scrolls themselves led to nothing but us finding these leftover, hardened kind of seals. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that you had a gabbai, and the gabbai knows exactly what scrolls are what. So let's say I have a shamash and a shul. Who knows exactly, you know, out of the 12 Torahs, which one is the one that, has this or has that, it's rolled here, it's rolled. It's quite an impressive thing.
It's
quite an impressive thing when you have a real collection of scrolls. Who knows about the ketav of which scroll? So someone like this, I told you about this once, but I'll tell you quickly again. Before you had Torahs written with vavs at the beginning of every column of a Torah now, the writing of a Torah scroll didn't necessarily start with a vav at the beginning of every column. You didn't have a standardized way that Sofrim copied an entire Torah into a scroll. That happened mid-18th century. So a good gabbai would know which was the easiest scroll to read this parsha from. Where did the aliyot break? Grab that one for that parsha. Which is the one that's going to be best for the kid reading the clearest ketav, if we could circulate more than one, because maybe they didn't have a family name attached to one and they circulate it for the one whole cycle of reading. Different scrolls have a different character, different nature. Somebody who knows about their scrolls within their house, because remember the chiddush was that we're not talking about the Beit Knesset. We're not talking about the shul. We're talking about the home. They would know their scrolls. It's a personal library. They didn't have that many books. Okay, so the bottom of the left-hand column, 116a2. V'tepu klei mishum hahu, but derived that the scroll should be saved on account of that. That what? That the very margins just mentioned have the kedusha. Since the Braita requires that the scroll possess 85 letters, we may derive that the margins don't merit saving, though. The Gemara replies, the Gaizu Shadi. So, let me tell you about the situation we're talking about. You're really asking me about Gilyanim, about the blank pages that have been what? where the margins were cut off and thrown away. Meaning what? Imagine a piece of one of the sections of a Torah, Gilayon, a Yiriyah. So if you think about it, the margins are removed, and the Torah passage that was once written there was erased. So in essence, what did I do? I cut away the blank stuff. Why did I cut away the blank stuff in the ancient world? So I can reuse it. I could stitch it together. I could glue it together. I could do whatever I wanted. I've got this piece that had Torah writing on it. It's blank. It's rolled up. It's part of my collection. Why did I not reuse it right away? A, it had Torah writing on it. B, I'm worried that maybe it does have a certain level of Kedusha. I don't know yet. C, I just didn't use it yet. It's in the collection with my scrolls. And that's the one that ultimately the Braita was talking about. I'm not worried about the blank spots around and on top of it. I'm not worried that it was the one that had two columns left blank that was used to stitch to the Eitz Chaim, the post at the end of the Torah. I'm not worried that this was the blank space between the two columns of writing. I'm just concerned with this spot that it was cut that had writing. Oh, but what do I still have the question about if I read it this way? I still have the question of the blank spaces between the letters. The blank spaces between the lines. Remember that one of the functional ways that we differentiated our kitav, our writing, was that no letter and no part of a letter actually touched each other if it had various parts. It's required to have space. So is that space inherently holy, or is the letter inherently holy? It's an interesting kind of question. You know, people in poetry circles talk about the caesura, right? The pregnant pause. People in listening to music, discerning listeners, say they can hear the spaces between the notes.
John Cage. Classic John Cage philosophy.
So there you have it. So I think...
He had the X number of minutes that was totally silent.
4 minutes and 33 seconds. Four minutes and 33 seconds is the name of the composition.
Yes. So
when they asked him which is more important, the sound or the rest, he actually said the silent part is more important than the sound.
Right. So it's interesting if you want to get some further detail about his, you can Google this, and there's some wonderful reflection on John Cage's relationship to the silent parts. Here. Just to bring it back to Jewish philosophers, the question of whether or not Torah is the black letters and the black letters only, or it's black fire on white fire,
right. The white fire,
is really a fundamental question of religious mystic philosophy.
And what are the Ten Commandments? Not written on, but
right, and there's a tradition that they were written right through the stone.
So they were blank and written at
right.
the same time.
So I feel like this part of the Gemara is having us think about the physicality of Torah, the kind of presentation of what holiness is. Is holiness the concrete symbolic peace that we can see, or is holiness the kind of space between the symbol once removed from, if you will, blank, the blank, the space. And the space between letters, the space between the lines, if that's what gives this Kedusha, then I can go and I can say it. So the Gemara continues. Tashma. Hagilyonin shomala v'shomata shebein parasha lefarisha shebein daf ledaf shebetchilat ha-sefer shebesof ha-sefer mitam'in et ha-yadayim. And here's how I'll prove to you that the blank spaces and the blank parts will actually have some type of holiness. They'll actually make your hands ritually impure, in the sense that the rabbis felt that things that were in this status could depart, could impart a certain ritual impurity to you if you touch them. Therefore, don't touch this holy thing. So if they do that, we see that the margins of the scroll have the same sanctity as the scroll itself, as the writing itself. Gemara, though, is going to dismiss the proof and dismiss the claim. Dilma agav sefer Torah shani. Perhaps when the margins are together with an unerased Torah scroll, it's different. So if you're telling me that that's the way it is with an erased Torah, I could tell you simply that it's that way. No, when the Torah actually is written and when it's not full of its writing, then what? Doesn't have the same level of holiness. Gemara's final statement, final attempt to resolve, a final attempt to kind of work out the positioning. Tashma, Hagilyonin v'sifre, before we get into the final kind of resolution of this discussion. So, one area that we're going to encounter right here in the Gemara is the entire nature of the rabbis feeling, as we talked about with some kinds of texts, who's in, who's out. The rabbis are going to present an argument within the stream of argumentation that we've been looking at, but we're going to get into mentioning those who are not of our community, those who are outside the bounds, those who are outside the bounds philosophically, religiously, those who are outside the bounds by way of their textual production. And it's important to note that they're doing that vis-a-vis both the current discussion of our Sefer Torah and comparing this other sect's texts to ours and learning from them at the same time. You know, they're in the picture. Tashma, come and learn. Hagilyonim v'sifrei meaning, the blank portions and books of the meaning. So it says in the note down here that books of scripture written in Hebrew and with kosher ink, but by Jews who have adopted idolatrous beliefs. Basically, by the Rashi, he tells you that they are idolaters. So, with regard to their books, Ein matzilin otam mitnei hadoleika, we may not save them from a fire on the Shabbat, on the Sabbath, Eila nisrafin binkoman hen v'az karotehen. They're allowed to burn along with whatever divine names are written in the text. My love, Gilyon, in the Sefer Torah. Now, by blank portions, does it not mean the blank portions of a Torah scroll? Thus we see that what? The blank portions of Torah scrolls may not be saved. The Gemara says, Lo, Gilyon, in the Sefer Amini. No, it means the blank portions of books of sectarians. In other words, it's talking about the meanings books. And the Gemara now questions the interpretation. Hash, the Sefer Amini, Gufayhu ein Masilin. Now, if the Braita teaches that the books of sectarians themselves may not be saved, the books themselves may not be saved, Gilyonin Mibaya? Is it necessary to state that the blank portions should, you know, of these books should be saved or not saved? I don't need to deal with that. The Gemara accepts the refutation and offers another interpretation of the Braita. Hachi Kamar, this is what it's saying. B'sifrei minin harei hen ke Gilyonin. That the books of scriptures written by sectarians are like blank portions of the parchment. They are like blank pieces of parchment on which no words of the Torah were ever written. By grouping these books together with never written on blank pieces of parchment, the Braita indicates the utter lack of sanctity of the books. Who are the Minyan, by the way? They, according to Rashi, are idol worshippers. According to argument, people around who chose that direction instead of maintaining loyalty to the Jewish people. They were writing their own books. They were a certain sect of people who had books of their own. Oh, so wait a minute. The Jews. Let's now separate. Are we talking about, well, are we talking about early Christian messianic adopters, or are we talking about people who worship idols, Allah, the kind of gods that existed in a pagan pantheon with Rome, or with a Zoroastrian reality with the power of light and the power of darkness? And is that idolatry? Yeah, well, that's at least that you have two gods. It's not. The argument about who actually fits into the category of meaning of these sectarians is one that's been alive and around since
Talmud.
Yeah, the Talmud. and articles about really what is it trying to define? Is it the Jewish idolaters with Zoroastrian leanings? Is it the Jewish pagans with Roman temple leanings? Is it early adopter Jesus followers who were still keeping Jewish practice? The interesting piece about Jews for Jesus is that's definitely one of the sects that is developing in the ancient rabbinic theater. They are people who held true to reading the Torah, even following law that might look a little bit like normative halakha, or the halakha of the time, and then took on this belief in a Messiah.
But isn't it the same as an inside group defining who's inside and who's out? The chief rabbi of Israel, can say if you're Reform or
you're in, you're out.
It's just, and maybe they're idolaters, but whatever it is, we don't know. But we know they were defined as not in.
Well, at a certain point, we have to decide whether or not saying who's in and saying who's out is, in a certain sense, necessary for cultural productivity.
Yes.
And so the rabbis are willing to say, we're producing a culture here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a set of beliefs that we believe, you know, points to God's hopes for the world and our people. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, the answer is yes, it is like that. But it's not like that in the sense that the chief rabbi, because all happen to agree today, and the Pew Research, by the way, says that one of the things that Jews simply don't really accept, if they're going to be called Jewish from whatever standpoint, is that Jesus is the Messiah and the Savior. So I suppose that line of thought presenting itself, if meaning, does mean anything about the Messiah in that vein of accepting Jesus, was really out there at the time. And in the marketplace of religious ideas, they were definitely setting up shop against such a reality.
Okay. Just two things. One is that I'm surprised at the notion of erasure is accepted, meaning that they didn't challenge that having made the stroke on the parchment, that even though you get rid of the ink, and maybe you didn't get rid of the ink completely, that the putting the stylus with the ink on the parchment does something to change the parchment that you can't really necessarily erase completely.
It's always there.
What?
It's always there. That's my x-ray point.
Well, and this is sort of gets into the question of palimpsest, where they've gone back when, because there've been many great works. I'm most familiar with the one about Archimedes, where they were able to uncover previous writings when, in fact, they had quote-unquote erased and then reuse the parchment for something new. In that case, it was used for a prayer book, a Christian prayer book, but it was clearly the original Archimedes' writing underneath and on the side. The other thing is, I think there are a lot of psychological studies of cultures where the foreground versus the background is more important. And the ones that I know where the hunter is really focused on looking for the lion, but cultures that are at sea looking at the horizon, actually, when confronted with the same images, they'll see either the white or the black as their primary, so there's a lot of conditioning as to whether or not how you perceive images in terms of foreground, background. And I wonder, I was just thinking in the desert environment, whether or not people living in cities are more foreground people, people living in the desert are more background people, and whether or not they shook out in any way in that regard.
I don't know if it impacted their textual productivity practices or not, but for sure parchments and animals were some text faded and they erased it and they had no problem. It was better than burning it, reusing it for another purpose, reusing for a holy purpose was important. I'm sure that they didn't use it just for mercantile records. We pretty much surmise. If I may, with two minutes left, I'd like to finish the one piece about the minin that's in the Gemara. And that is that it says gufa. So let's really hit this issue. Hagilyoni v'sifrei minin, the blank portions in the books of the sectarians. Ein matilin otam yidnei adoleka. You don't save them from the fire. Rabbi Yossi says, b'chol koderet haz karot shebehen begoznan v'shar sorfan. During the weekday, what do you do when you find these books? You cut out the names of God that are within them, and you burn them. And you bury them. And the rest of the book, you burn it. You cut out the names of God, and you bury them or hide them away, gonzan, and the rest you burn. I'm not Rabbi Tarfon, but Rabbi Tarfon says, Akapach et banai she'im yavo lidev she'ani esrof otam ve'et azkarot shebehen. If I will bury my sons, if were such books to come to my hand, I would not burn them together with the divine names they contain. He says, I'm not going to cut the names out and put them in the holy trove with the worn out texts with the names of God over there. I'm burning everything if I find these meanings texts. Shafilu adam rodef acharav lahorgo. For Rabbi Tarfon says, even if a person were pursuing to kill him, v'nachash ratzla kisho, and a snake were running after him to bite him, nichnas leved avodah zarah, he would enter a Gentile house of idolatry to save himself, v'ein nichnas levetan shel elu, but he would not enter the house of these Jewish sectarians, shehalalu makirin v'chofrin, because these were Jewish sectarians aware of God, but completely deny God's existence. V'halalu ein makirin v'chofrin, but the idol worshippers, at least, were unaware of God and didn't really deny him. V'alehen akatuv omer, and concerning them, scripture states, v'achar adelet v'hamezuzah samt zichronech, and behind the door and the doorpost you have set their memory, meaning you've totally removed the presence of God, and your texts simply negate all of God's existence. So, there's a certain type of polemic against this group that's extant, regardless. The Avodah Zarah, the idol worship people, are separated from those who deny God's existence or who deny that God is one and accept the Messiah. The whole debate hasn't been answered. And the Gemara goes forward to say, that's when the name of God can be burned, versus buried in the Geniza, as our Mishnah said, that the names of God and the texts that are worn out have to be either closed up in a cabinet or buried in the earth for Geniza purposes. Erev Tov. Carol, you didn't get the timing. There were emails and newsletters.
I thought it was newsletter today.
No.
Okay.
Oh, sorry that you missed that.
I was wondering
if you were away.
I didn't make it to the last first three classes.
Sharing.
I think we only have two, right?
She wasn't.
Of course I could.
She wasn't a good
speaker.
I
missed the
Well, welcome back to it. You want to learn the Mishnah together? We can have a chavruta.
This brings me to Birkat Aminim של המלשינים לא תהיה תקווה. It was all written in the same time. So it should be, probably there was a little, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai worked very hard against the malshinim, so to speak.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, the same.
It is all from the same.
Yeah, it's the same. So these are where the
Laura? Did you get my email? No? So.
Did you drop the quarter?
Yes.
It did work.